Monday morning. Hope your day's off to a pretty good start so far this morning, coming up to 10:07. Hi, and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker is, did I say astrophysicist? anyway, it's one of those Mondays, I guess. St. Mary's astrophysicist Rob Thacker is settling in for another edition of Science Files this morning, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11 this morning, it's your turn to sound off. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. And, of course, as always, anything goes. And after the news at noon, we'll hear another Halifax History Moment with historian and author Blair Bead. And PC leader Tim Houston will join me this afternoon for some political talk today. 10:07 right now, but this hour it's time for Science Files, our weekly look at news from the world of science. And back with us this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning to you, Dr. Rob.
Good morning.
I screwed up the physicist because there was a song on the weekend I was humming around. It's Hippopotamus for Christmas and all the hippopotamuses. Something along those lines. Anyway, that's my excuse and I'm sticking to it. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 if you've got a question. For Dr. Rob here this morning, you can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question, our Twitter handle, at The Rick Howe Show. Well, the COP 25, thank you very much, ended on the weekend, and kind of a disappointing end, I guess. The UN Secretary General says he was disappointed they couldn't come to any kind of agreement on a final statement, and so a lot of disappointment, I guess, Dr.
Yeah,
Rob.
No,
your take on this.
It's frustrating. And so here we have a situation where all of the countries in the world have got to come together to actually agree on some kind of way of moving forward. I mean, the point of COP25 was really to try and put into place a way of moving forward on the agreements of Paris. So that's kind of failed spectacularly. A number of the bigger emitters have concerns about wanting to use carbon credits for the past in one way or another, I think the issue is. And so that's not going to help us, and it's deeply problematic. You can see a lot of people were quite upset about it. The bigger problem in all of this is we can't keep kicking the can down the road.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that the younger generation is acutely aware of, because those are the people who are going to feel this over their lifetimes the most. And it's not surprising that they are getting more and more concerned about it. And I mean, I don't know what to say about the whole Greta Thunberg thing. I mean, kudos to her. It's incredible what this kid is going around. I say kid, young woman.
She's 16, yeah.
What this young woman is doing. And that is absolutely exceptional and bringing forward the issue. I mean, I know she gets criticized because she's not a scientist. She's not a politician, but she's someone who is very concerned. And I think it's completely legitimate for a citizen to bring forward those concerns and vocalize them to an entire generation, which is exactly what she's doing. And hopefully we will come to see some sense over the next few months and start making things move forward. I mean, this is the unfortunate problem with any kind of global system where everyone can rely on a common infrastructure, and that is the atmosphere. And so you get this concept called the tragedy of the commons, where it's always in someone's best interest to do what they can with a given resource, but when everyone does it, you get a problem.
Yeah. Right. You mentioned, again, Greta and how she has inspired millions, including many youths who have taken to the Friday climate strikes, for example. And in fact, many of the youths who went to this Madrid meeting also came away very disappointed and suggesting that the world leaders, you know, don't practice what they preach. They pointed out the plastic utensils that were served at food. They pointed out the airplane travel that the world leaders came to participate in this meeting.
Everyone's a hypocrite, right? That's a reality, right? We all try not to be hypocrites, but every now and again we do stuff that is like against what we say we're going to do. And so that's true for me in terms of like the fact that I travel a lot for my job and I still going around talking about climate change. The key problem that I have with many things is if we had really good video technology solutions, we'd do that. In fact, one of the problems with video technologies is if you have some people in a room and some people video conferencing in, it's really imbalanced. If everyone's video conferencing in, it works, right? And similarly, if everyone is in the room, it works. It's when you have a mixture that you get problems. But at the end of the day, yes, there's always hypocritical things going on. The question is, how do we change the conversation towards doing all of these sustainable things as a matter of course? It shouldn't be something you have to think about. And I can think about a good example of this, and I'm particularly aware of accessibility concerns, making like closed caption TV and things like that. In fact, I was giving a TV channel a hard time about this weekend.
I saw that.
But I still forget. I still forget to sort out interpreters for things and so on. And that's a problem, right? And so you can call me out and say, hey, you forgot. You're a problem. And I'm like, I'll go, yeah, I've got to do better, right? So we all have to start doing better, right? And I think climate change is the classic example of that, that there are so many things going on that we don't factor in when we make decisions, that we've got to start changing that discussion. We've got to start making the implications of what we do be more something that we think about on a day-to-day basis. And at the moment, we're very divorced from that, right? And until we can start changing that conversation and understanding the impact of the things we do on a daily basis, I'm really concerned that it's going to be hard to make this thing move forward.
Canada's new Environment Minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, has joined the chorus of those concerned or upset or disappointed with the outcome of the COP25 conference. He says, and I quote here, Canada came to COP25 in the spirit of compromise and commitment to action. While there was some successes, we are disappointed that the world was not able to agree on the rules for the international carbon markets that would help us raise our ambition in Madrid. Again, he and many others, including the UN Secretary General, expressing some disappointment at the outcome of this COP25. But there's COP26, I believe, in Glasgow, Scotland.
Glasgow. Going to be in Glaswegian.
10:14 is the time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files on a Monday morning. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We just had a couple of email questions come in. We'll get to those. And again, you can also tweet us a comment or a question. Our Twitter handle at The Rick Howell Show. We'll be back with more with Dr. Rob right after this.
I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus.
I can listen to the song for...
She's teasing you.
She is indeed. Thanks, Katie.
Go on, Katie.
10:17. Mark emails a question here this morning. He says, what came first, time or space? But he says, I know this question is probably impossible to answer, but it reminds me of the chicken or the egg debate. And he also wonders, are astronauts in the space station looking up or looking down at Earth?
Okay. So this is actually really very difficult, and he's all too well aware of how difficult it is.
Okay.
And so one of the challenges is that we all tend to think of time as this immutable thing because we live in a particular state of the universe where time is flowing like a river for us. There's nothing we can do to stop it, and it just happens. And so that made Newton talk about time as being this immutable thing, just like space. It's out there. You can't change it. It's a property of the universe and so on. But where that gets complicated is when you go back to the beginning of the universe, to the very earliest moments. And when you do that, you have to start using Einstein's theory of relativity. And when you start doing that, time and space become wrapped together in something called four-dimensional space-time. And they can swap properties to one another. The same kind of thing goes on in black holes as well. This sounds really freaky, and it is a little bit freaky. And so the question of what happens at the beginning of the universe and what does it mean in terms of what's happening with time at the beginning of the universe, can you talk about what happened before the beginning of the universe, is a really difficult question. And we don't have really good answers to it. There are theories in which there were other things going on before the beginning of our current universe. You can talk about meta-universes, higher dimensional universes, and so on. That's in string theory. But there are also theories that pertain to the very creation of the universe being a singular point in both space and time. And you could have the concept of time as being a little bit like the concept of north. Right? Where we are right now, north means something. And I can say, let's go north to the North Pole, Rick, and we can keep on going, and we can get closer and closer. As we get closer to the North Pole, I can say, let's carry on going to the North Pole, Rick, and you're like, okay, I know where that is, and you'll keep going. And then when you hit the North Pole, and I say, Rick, okay, let's go north now, you kind of go, oh, I can't.
Yeah.
Right? And time could possibly be like that, right? Mm. that it's a concept that only exists because of the properties of the space that you are in. And so it may be, it just may be, that time and space are so interlinked with one another that the question of does time come first or does space come first is in fact not the appropriate question. It's in fact that they are born together.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how about the chicken or the egg debate then?
I think the answer to that one is eggs.
Mm-hmm. And what about this question, the astronauts in space, are they looking up or are they looking down at Earth?
Oh, that's just a frame of reference thing. I mean, as the space station, if you could rotate it around, they could be looking up, they could be looking down, it doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
It's just all.
Yeah, all right. Eric's on the line. He's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Rick. Hello, Dr. Rob. Merry Christmas, both of you.
Yeah, and
right
to
back
you. At you.
Dr. Rob, I read an article a couple of months ago. It was written by an investigative reporter for The Guardian, mm-hmm. and he was talking about carbon credits and offsets. And what he said in his article was that the analogy he gave, if you took a flight from London to New York and you took out your calculator and bought your carbon credits, it would mean that you would buy an offset, and that offset of trees would have to be maintained and survive for 100 years to offset the amount of carbon that was used in that trip. What's your opinion on that?
I can't give you a quick answer to that because I'd have to sit down and do the math on how many tons of CO2 that would amount to, or grams, kilograms of CO2 that would amount to. I do know that with, for example, biofuel burning, there is a real concern that while, yes, you can replant, the problem with replanting is it takes a significant amount of time for the forest to reach a stage where it is acting as a strong sink of carbon. It's just because small trees don't absorb as much carbon for obvious reasons. And so it's certainly true that when you replant systems, you take a number of years for those to reach a point where they are actually sequestering a lot of carbon. And that's probably about the best comment I can give on that.
And my second question is, if I go back to St. Mary's and get a degree in astrophysics, will I be able to break 80 regularly in golf like you do?
No, go.
I haven't figured it out yet.
You're far better
I've
off
never
just
broken 80. I'm jealous.
Far better off practicing your golf than getting a degree.
Oh, okay, take care.
Thanks, Eric. You shoot under 80 now, do you?
Yeah.
Wow, you're a pro.
No, but I probably could have been.
You could have been. Yeah. If you continue to practice, you can still.
Well, I'm trying to shoot level par, and I've done it in a in fact, I've done under par in a simulator, but I've got to shoot level par on a course.
Do you use your expertise as an astrophysicist to direct the ball in some way?
No. I mean, it really, I understand the physics of what's happening in the game better because I know a lot of physics. But it doesn't, it's truly, it's a game. Like, and I caddied for some pros at the event that they held at Oakfield. And I mean, these are nice enough individuals, but they have no idea about the spin effect on the ball when they hit it. They've just hit so many thousands and thousands and thousands of golf balls that they know what's going to happen when they hit it.
Yeah.
Right?
Fascinating. 10:23 is the time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files, and I'm reading here about an interstellar visitor that could be lighting up the skies in time for the holidays. Comet Borisov is the second known celestial object to visit our solar system from deep space. And this is something that was just discovered by amateur astronomer Gennady Borisov, by the way.
Well, in August. He's a very advanced amateur astronomer.
So he's not what you call your junior kind of guy.
No, he's a technician at an observatory.
All right. But he just discovered it in August. So I guess my other question here is, how many of these other things are out there that you know, suddenly pop into view that might give us a bit of a surprise?
We have no
here.
Idea. I mean, well, we have no idea. We can estimate how many of these things are out there, but we really don't know, right? And so actually, so funnily enough, this does key into us talking about Starlink the other week. So one of the big goals of the new Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, we've mentioned this a few times, this is being built in Chile. It's largely an American project, but with some Canadian involvement in other countries too. So that's going to be surveying the whole sky every 3 days. And the point of that is you're going to have this really big telescope taking, you can kind of think of it as a snapshot of the sky every 3 days. And that will enable us to find lots more of these particular things. In this particular case, Borisov was found by Gennady Borisov using his own 0.6-meter telescope, right, which is actually quite a big telescope. It's the same size as the one that we have in our observatory. And so that's something where you literally, you take a picture, you come back to the same area a few nights later and you take a picture and you literally see what's moved, right? And if you find something that's moved, you've got something that's coming in really fast, or it's actually fairly close to the Earth, one of those two things. And so in this particular case, he's lucked out and he's found something that's coming, as far as we can tell, from considerably outside the solar system, and it's claimed to be interstellar. So this is the first example of a comet, Oumuamua,
yeah,
right? The first one that we sort of found. That, it's still sort of like not entirely, it was slightly more rocky than it was comet-like, right? And so, but in this case, it does really look like a comet, and so it's zipping around, and they've already pointed the Hubble at it, I believe. And so there'll be a few more observations taken, I'm sure, to try and characterize it further as it goes around.
I'm reading here a quote from a professor of astronomy at Yale who says that this is a leftover remnant of a planet formation process in an alien system of planets. What's that say? What's that mean in English?
Okay. So the planets, solar systems form basically, or planetary systems, I should say. Solar system means our planetary system. But planetary systems form around stars as the star is forming. And so you have a disk of material that's cooling down, and as it cools down, you can imagine the gravity pulling material together, starting to form planets and so on. And now there will be a lot of things going on within that, and there will be big collisions of bigger things hitting one another, and then every now and again, those collisions may end up launching something out while those planets are forming.
Yeah.
And so that's what they think has gone on here, and it's literally gone through interstellar space and come into our planetary system. So there's all sorts of what we call scattering events going on while planets are being formed, and this is a byproduct of that.
It says here, scientists have no idea where this comet came from, but it almost certainly ejected from a young planetary system by gravitational interaction with a large planet.
Yep.
Fascinating. And so how do we know that it came from outside our solar system?
Right. So that's actually comparatively straightforward. So what you do is you look at the parameters of the orbit, of basically its path that it's traveling on. And from that, we can see that it's not gravitationally bound to the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's not gravitationally bound to the sun, that means it's coming in with a speed that puts it from coming from outside of the solar system.
Okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell us here when we might be able to see this. Will we be able to see this with the
naked
eye? I don't
actually know what the expected maximum magnitude is. I can do a little bit of homework and try and find that out.
Sure. Okay. It just says here it's in time for the holidays. So if we could find that out, that would be good. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a comment or a question for Dr. Rob here this morning.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. I don't think you're going to be able to see it with the naked eye.
Oh, well, too bad.
Yeah. Paul, a fairly big telescope.
Paul and Brian are on hold. We'll get to you first, but we have to take a break for a news update. And we'll be back with more with Dr. Rob after the news, and the news is coming up next. 10:32 here on a Monday morning. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us in the studio till 11 for another edition of Science Files. And if you've got a comment or a question for Dr. Rob here, give us a call at 902-405-6000. Or 1-877-801-8255, just like Paul has done here this morning. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Good morning, Paul.
My question is, yesterday at a dinner table, my sister and family, we were talking about clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trying to explain to me the formation of clouds and what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, the best person to ask that to is Dr. Rob, because he's going to be on in the morning. So just to let you know, my sister is home probably listening to this conversation.
Yeah.
And can you explain to us or me, because they might think they know more than me,
mm-hmm.
but I think you know more than us, all about the cloud formations and the type of clouds and that kind of stuff. And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Sure.
Okay. That's a pretty general question.
I should say that the real expert to ask on this would be Richard Zarowski.
That's right.
I mean, he's a qualified meteorologist. But anyway, so the basic, and there is more than one way to form a cloud as well, but most of it basically involves different types of pressure and different types of moisture. And so the classic sort of like explanation for how clouds form is you come down to the ground level and you've got warmth at the ground level. You've got warm air and you've got moisture in the air. Now, everyone knows that warm air tends to rise. And so the air rises up. As it rises up, it's going to cool down, right? So as it starts to cool down, then it's going to have more and more probability of actually basically turning back into water, right? And so the question will be, what makes it turn back into water? What makes it precipitate? And the answer is you need nucleation sites. You need small particulates that are in the atmosphere themselves, and those will serve as a point where you can literally start condensing out the water. And then once that starts happening, then you'll start seeing the clouds everywhere. So that's the sort of like the traditional explanation for how you get clouds. But anyone who's been to a mountain range will know that you can often see clouds on the other sides of tall mountains.
That's
as
right.
Well, right? Yep. And so that's related to changes in pressure. So as pressure changes as well, as you get low pressure, everyone knows if you have a barometer at home, you're more likely to have rain when you have low pressure. That will make precipitation more likely as well. And so you can have that on the other side of a mountain, you'll see a cloud forming. And that's because of the change in pressure of the air as the air goes all around the mountain as well.
Okay. Clouds can also be an indicator of weather coming, right? A mackerel, the fish scale clouds, the mackerel, they call it the mackerel sky. Is it an indicator of rain on the way, perhaps, that kind of thing?
So here's the thing. So I think I could be wrong. I'm going to have to search, but maybe a meteorologist would correct me. But I think that kind of situation occurs because you have two layers of air moving across one another.
Okay.
Right? And there is something called the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability that will cause different areas of pressure. You'll get sort of a high-low. And then you'll get these sort of like mackerel stripes, as it were, because of the changes in pressure.
Fascinating.
I think that's the explanation. Well, I might be wrong.
Well, we'll have to get Zarowski in sometime, too.
No, Richard knows all of this. Yeah. I mean, that was his job, for heaven's sake.
It was, indeed. Frank, with a question, he wonders, why is the Earth spinning on an axis that no other planets do, or do they? And could you explain the Coriolis effect? Is it real? And if so, is this effect present in some form on other planets that don't spin? And before you answer this, he also writes, I think up these questions and save them for the show. I could Google them, but I never do. I pretend on Mondays during Science Files that Google doesn't exist. I enjoy listening to Dr. Rob's down-to-earth, no pun intended, simple but eloquent explanations, and look forward to them. And the Coriolis question comes from the novel Supertanker, its effect on large vessels, he writes.
Okay. So the best way for me to explain the Coriolis force is to remind everyone of what it's like to be a kid on a roundabout.
Okay.
And so when you're a kid on a roundabout and you're spinning around, you can see the person in front of you and you feel that push, right? Have you ever tried to throw something at the person who's across from you? If you've ever tried to do that, you know it looks really, really weird because you throw something, instead of going straight towards the person, it will fly off
to the side.
To the side, right? And so that is an example of what's called fictitious forces in what we call rotating reference frames. And so whenever you're spinning around, the physics is a little bit different, right? Because we're used to sort of like moving in straight lines, moving around without that spinning motion. And as soon as you start making things spin around, then you get to see things just behaving in slightly weird ways. The best example I can give you is that idea of throwing something. And that curve that you get is an example, in one way or another, of the Coriolis effect.
Okay. So how does this tie into the spinning planet Earth?
And so that's caused because the Earth is spinning as well. And you get slightly different effects on the surface of a sphere spinning around. But the overall idea that it's related to the fact that everything is moving around in curves is the same. Right. And so that's where the Coriolis effect comes from. I teach it in the third year, actually. We even kind of teach it a little bit in second year as well. But in the third year, we do it from an operator perspective. And so that allows you to calculate the impact. And it's one of the reasons why, for example, weather systems move as they do. Right? It's related to the Coriolis force. So it's real, and it is solely a product of rotation. So if you have a planet that's not spinning...
And there are planets that don't spin, right? Yes, no, maybe so?
Not that we're aware of.
Okay, all right.
So planets... There may be planets that are spinning more slowly, comparatively speaking, but there are no planets that I'm aware of that don't spin at all. That's a difficult thing to achieve, right? Because angular momentum, the spin... The property that keeps things moving forward is called momentum.
Yep.
And so the property that keeps things spinning is called angular momentum. And so angular momentum, once things start spinning, they want to keep on spinning and so on. And so the answer is, if you had a planet that just miraculously happened to not be spinning, then you wouldn't have the Coriolis effect. Right. So lastly, the question was, are all planets spinning?
Yes.
Are they all spinning the same way? All planets are spinning, yes, but no, they're not all spinning the same way. In particular, Venus is flipped around and spinning the other way.
Counterclockwise.
Or
clockwise.
Depends upon which way, whether you look from the bottom or from the top. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So where that spin comes from is as the sun is forming and the planets are forming in the solar nebula around it, that is a disk of material, and it's all sort of like disks forming planets within the disk around the star. So they all sort of are likely to get the same kind of spin to begin with, but everything isn't simple as that. So there can be interactions that knock things off. You can have two sort of like things come together, form another planet in a big collision, and then that excess angular momentum of that interchange can be in a different direction relative to the spin. Most planets tend to sort of spin in the same direction, but certainly Venus is the other way, and Neptune is really inclined at an angle as well, if I remember correctly.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Let's go to Brian on the line with a question here this morning. Hi, Brian.
Morning. Thanks again, Rick, for taking my call, Dr. Rob.
Hey, Brian.
This is my favorite part of your show. Only beats out the open line part. But my question for you, Dr. Rob, is how much of an effect does clear cutting have on global warming? And if would it make much of a difference if, I think you touched on this earlier, if we made the people that were clear cutting plant, say, 5 trees every tree they cut down, maybe one of those 5 might survive to be an adult and replace the one they cut down. And my other part is, last week, I believe it was, I talked to you about dropping nuclear waste into a volcano to try and get rid of it. Now, I'm just wondering, water is a really good insulator against radiation. What if we took the nuclear waste and, say, dropped it, I don't know, down in the Mariana Trench, where it's 2 miles deep? It would probably take 1,000 years or more just for the water to circulate out, but the radiation wouldn't go with it. So okay. I'm just wondering what would that be like. And sure. One last thing, which I didn't plan on saying, but you're talking about cloud formation, and I used to own a sailboat, and there's the saying, mare's tails soon to shorten sails, means that if you see those mare's tails up in the sky, means that wind is coming. So that's it.
All right. You. Appreciate the call, Brian. Right. Thanks very much. Where
so
do you want to start?
Let's start with dropping stuff into the Marianas Trench.
Okay.
And I can appreciate the logic. The bigger issue there is how currents move and what happens to whatever you put down there. So as a sort of place to put something, we've dumped stuff in the oceans for so long, we have to stop doing that.
Yeah.
Right. And so I understand the logic. I really do. But we can't look upon the oceans as places to dump things. We have to get over that.
We've had conversations with a fellow of Cape Breton who is part of a worldwide effort to raise the alarm about munitions that have been dumped off the coast. It's ridiculous.
No. I mean, I know the oceans are huge. The oceans covers most of the surface of the planet, but nonetheless, they are a fundamental resource for the ecosystem that basically keeps us alive to a certain extent, or many hundreds of millions of people alive. And so we have to be really careful about this. The idea is sensible. But the problems are that if you put material down there that ends up leaking, then currents will move that all around, and so you'll end up with problems at the end of the day. So with radioactive waste, you're literally better off putting it somewhere where you can monitor it. It's always better to be able to monitor it. And what was the other first part of the question?
It was clear cut and its impact on global warming.
I can't give a straight-up answer to that because it's obviously about forestry management, and it depends entirely upon how all of that is done. Like, if you clear-cut a small area and you go from area to area and then you're replanting effectively, there's probably not that significant a difference to just, like, cutting down a few trees and so on. But you are changing the overall rate at which the carbon is being sequestered by clear cutting. And so nonetheless, as I said, the thing was, if you clear cut an area so you go back to essentially like saplings growing and so on, and then you've got a very low carbon sink rate for that particular area. Whereas if you just cut down a few trees and you leave them going, then you're not really totally knocking it down that much.
But trees are an important part of our atmosphere. I mean,
oh, they're
trees
huge, absolutely. No, I mean, the amazing thing about trees is when you look at a tree, you've got to remind yourself that all of that wood is basically carbon that's been sucked out of the air, right? And once you realize that, you realize how important trees are to the actual nature of the atmosphere. Now, there are other things, of course. I mean, biota in the oceans as well, they play an important role in converting CO2 as well. But nonetheless, trees are just this incredible thing that we have that is nonetheless constantly turning carbon from the air, CO2 from the air, into carbon in the amazing thing that is wood.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. 10:45, he's Dr. Rob Thacker. This is Science Files here on a Monday morning. We're going to take another quick break. Rick, stay there. You're coming up right after we come back from this.
Beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Not after that rain we got on the weekend. Wow, it was a wild and woolly weekend, was it not?
It certainly was.
Indeed. But there's snow in the forecast, I believe, Wednesday into Thursday. Could be up to 15 centimeters if things
Sorry, we've
up.
Already had some classes canceled because exams canceled because of bad weather last week in the power outage. So.
Well, stay tuned. Could be more on its way. Rick, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Hey, Rick.
Dr. Rob, look, the moon, it's up there, and it's our closest thing we can examine and know the most about physically, because I guess we've been there. But I was reading something that the moon has a 13 and a half day and a 13 and a half day night.
Yes.
I'm just using the Earth's reference, okay? So I was reading that the temperature drops to, you know, minus a gazillion on the night part of it and plus a gazillion on the day part of it. And I'm just wondering if the moon had an atmosphere, how that would be mitigated, or would it be? And the converse of that would be if the Earth didn't have an atmosphere.
Okay.
So that's kind of like... So how they relate.
Sure.
And I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thanks, Rick.
All right, so what Rick is saying about the long day is true, and that happens because the moon is actually what we call tidally locked with the Earth. So one side of it is always facing towards the Earth, as we all know. We never see the far side of the moon, not the dark side.
I hear you. Right? I learned my lesson.
So that means although we see one face, it's still, as it goes around, seeing different parts of it towards the sun. So it is true. It does have a 13 and a half day a day and a 13 and a half day night. And so what would tend to happen if you had a situation in which a planet had an atmosphere but was then getting very hot on one side and very cool on the other side, so it wasn't constantly distributing that heat, is the atmosphere would try to redistribute that heat as best as it could. And so the way it would do that is wind.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's wind on the moon?
No, there isn't an atmosphere. Well, there's negligible atmosphere on the moon. I mean, people talk about it having atmosphere, but it's not an atmosphere like we have here, right? So it's essentially it's a vacuum, right, with very small amount of material there. And so if there was, just imagine a situation in which there was, say, a planet very close into a star, right, where only one side of it was facing towards the star and the other side was facing back outwards, then yes, there's a huge temperature differential. And so if there's a big change in temperature as you go from the dark side to the light side, in this case, we can say the dark side. And so that would be equalized by all of the gas in the atmosphere basically trying to transport the heat from the hot side all the way around to the cool side. So you would have crazy, crazy winds going on all the time, right? And so that's actually something that theorists work on, because a lot of the extrasolar planets we found around other stars, we think could be in that kind of situation as well, right? And so
fascinating.
Okay.
The things you learn here on this radio program, Dr. Rob.
Yep.
Just before we go to our next caller, I've been reading something here about, again, the rocket that will take mankind or humankind to Mars. Will it be built by NASA? Will it be built by SpaceX? Or a former astronaut who's tinkering around with something called plasma rocket engines?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not exactly sure what is a plasma rocket engine and how is that an advantage over what we have right now, or is it an advantage at all? And where are we at in regards to this?
If you could build it, yeah, it would be. So this is actually an idea that's been around for quite a long time. This has been around, I think, since the 1970s.
Okay.
And so the essential way a rocket works is you're literally accelerating by throwing something out the back. Right. And because of the conservation of momentum, when you throw something out the back, you go forward.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's how a rocket works, except instead of throwing something, you're firing fuel that's burning and going very, very fast.
Yes.
Right. And so the faster you can make something go, the more momentum you can create. And so the idea of the Vasimir, I think it's called, plasma rocket
engine, right,
is to actually heat up gas into a plasma, strip out the electrons off the atoms, and then you've created a plasma. And then once you have a plasma, you can use magnetic fields to accelerate it out the back of the spacecraft. And so that's the fundamental idea. You can actually separate electrons from the atoms using ionizing radio frequencies. And so that then creates the plasma, and you essentially just push it out the back with a giant magnetic field. You probably have to use superconducting magnets and whatever. And so the challenge with this is basically coming up with an efficient enough way of doing this, because you can accelerate these individual particles, these charged particles, to a higher speed than you can launching chemical rockets out the back of a chemical rocket. And so that gives you the opportunity to build a rocket that in theory is more efficient than a chemical rocket. But there's a lot of technological issues to still be ironed out on this.
So there's not a working model right now, or is there?
So there are certain types of rocket that are a little bit like this that have been used, but there's nothing that can operate in the two different ways. The Vasimir rocket is capable of operating in what's called... I'm going to have to talk about specific impulse. I don't want to do that. Sort of like a high thrust and a low thrust mode.
Okay.
Right? Yep. And the high thrust mode is really good for getting out of a deep gravitational well that the Earth has. But then the low thrust mode is really efficient and gets you somewhere efficiently. Right?
So
being able to operate in those two regimes is the thing that makes this a really interesting idea. But there's a lot of technological issues to be worked out on it.
And is this a faster propulsion system?
You could, in theory, make it go faster. But the way that would happen is you would be accelerating constantly.
Okay.
Right. And so because of that constant acceleration, you can reach high speeds. But it's not a rapid acceleration, right? So you basically would spend most of your time accelerating up to the halfway point, then turn around and be accelerating as you go, decelerating as you go back on the other half.
This is a dream of Franklin Chang Diaz, who flew on the space shuttle a number of times and holds a PhD in plasma physics from MIT.
Yeah, no. Diaz is a smart chap. So, yeah. I mean, this is not a crazy idea. It's just very hard to do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Back to the phones and go. And Bob's on the line. Morning, Bob.
Morning, gentlemen. Merry Christmas to you both.
Well, Merry
and
Christmas
you,
to you, sir.
Dr. Rob, the magnetic field of the planet protects our atmosphere from solar winds. Is that correct?
Yep, within reason, yep.
Okay, and the carbon that we have contributed to our atmosphere, I guess the solar radiation comes in, hits the planet's surface, and is radiated back into the atmosphere, keeping us warm. Is that correct?
Within reason, yep.
Okay, so the reverse must be true, too. All the carbon that we're putting into our atmosphere from jets flying 5 miles into the atmosphere, then the solar radiation is probably reflected away from the planet of the surface. Is that not?
So, okay, I know what you're asking. So the thing to remember is, right, what happens is that the radiation comes in at one wavelength, it hits the surface of the Earth, and then it's re-radiated at a longer wavelength, and it is that carbon in the atmosphere that kind of serves to trap it because it's coming up at a different wavelength than what it came down at. That's probably the best way to think about it.
So it's radiated back, keeping us kind of warm. My question is the dynamics of the center of the Earth at the moment. The electromagnetic field generated by, I guess, the molten lava, 3,000 kilometers.
Yeah, the nucleus of the Earth, yep.
Yeah, the article I read was some kind of a river of iron that creates this electromagnetic field.
Sure, that's a reasonable enough analogy, yep.
And it's been drifting for years now. Actually, in my previous career, I used to use the declination to retrace steps of former surveys that were done 150 years ago, that kind of thing, compass bearings. And I did notice that the thing was increasing at a small rate in the 90s, but mm-hmm. has ever been increasing. The event of November 11th, 2018, do you know what that was about?
November the 11th? Not off the top
November
of my head.
It's when the whole planet rang like a bell. It did reach mainstream media a little bit. I found it interesting, of course, but most people probably wouldn't.
And Bob, I hate to cut you off here, but we're running out of time. So your question to the point is?
The dynamics of the world, I don't think, can be solved by human beings. And the fluid motion of the atmosphere, the electromagnetic fields that protect the atmosphere, that sort of thing. I think, of course, there's climate change. There's no doubt in my mind that that's happening. But it's which way it's going to head. We probably have taken the atmosphere to places where the history of the world has never, ever seen it before.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that global warming is a farce, and I think it may be going in the other direction.
And I'm
going
to stop.
What do you think of that?
All right. Appreciate it, Bob. And we're out of time here. Dr. Rob.
I'll respond quickly. So there's some elements of truth and other things that I would disagree with. So the answer is, can we understand the geodynamo mechanism that creates the magnetic field that we have around the planet? And the answer to that is yes. Can we ever know the interior of the state of the Earth itself well enough to know exactly what it's going to do? That may be no, because it's very difficult to make measurements of something down there. We can infer it from seismic measurements and so on, but that's a hard thing to do, right? So you can kind of have an idea of what could happen, but when things are going to happen, we don't really know. And what's the overall impact of putting more carbon into the atmosphere on these processes is negligible, right? Because the mass of the atmosphere is comparatively small, right, relative to the mass of the Earth. Right.
Very interesting hour.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
That's some great questions here this morning.
Absolutely.
Some good topics indeed. We're off next week.
I am. I'm going to be away.
Yep. And then we're off the following week because so we'll see you next time in early January.
Yeah, absolutely. So right. Happy New Year as well as Merry Christmas.
Merry
to
Christmas
happy
to you
holidays.
And your family as well. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here. It's now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update. And then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday. Anything goes next hour, and our phone lines await your calls now. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.